From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. We get an update as a former Michigan State University gymnastics teacher faces charges connected to the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal.
Clay, just, she is unique, but she is not the only person who, for quite some time, decided to try and stand by Nassar.
Cadillac's move to New York did not work out quite as planned.
We're going to go to New York. We're going to get a hipper image. We're going to hire people who are part of this coastal, cool elite.
Michigan Research is helping farmers and making energy in Puerto Rico.
Establishing gasifiers, which are a machine that basically uses biomass to produce gas.
And researchers find police shootings are different than most people think.
This was giving people actually an incorrect impression of what all police shootings were like, or what the majority of police shootings were like.
We also talked to the new superintendent at Flint Community Schools. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Candy. On today's show, we'll hear why investing in police bias training might not have much of an effect on lowering fatal shootings of black people.
When we looked at the data, we found that the police shootings were very different than what people thought they were. And because of that, training like implicit bias training, we think, is not going to do much.
But first, today a preliminary hearing on charges against a former Michigan State University gymnastics coach is being held. Kathy Klages has been charged with lying to police investigators who questioned her about the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal. You'll recall that Nassar was a physician at MSU who sexually assaulted more than 200 girls and young women, many of them in the MSU gymnastics program. Joining us now is Shayna Roth. She's Michigan Radio's Capitol reporter. Hi there.
Hello.
So what is Kathy Klages accused of lying about?
So essentially what the prosecutors are saying is that investigators went to Klages. They asked her, did gymnasts in the past ever come to you and say, Larry Nassar is abusing me or he's doing things that make me uncomfortable? And Klages said no. And now what is going to be happening today at the preliminary hearing is there are two women who say that that's not true, that they actually back in 1997 met with Klages. They said Larry Nassar was doing some things to them that they were not comfortable with, and that essentially they did in fact report it to her.
Well, why hasn't she been charged with more if, as their coach, she ignored the complaints that Nassar did inappropriate things with these teenage members of the gymnastic team?
So with that, there's an issue of the statute of limitations, that the things that she has potentially done in the past, the crimes that she may or may not have committed in the past, that they are no longer able to be prosecuted because of the time for that has run out.
I understand Klages has been a Nassar defender even after prosecutors recovered a computer drive with child pornography on it, which he got convicted for 60 years on that. Why is she so much of a fan of Nassar?
I mean, that's probably something that you'd have to ask Klages about. I think part of it is that not only Klages, but other people who stood by Nassar for a while, well into the proceedings, is he was a pillar of the community. You know, he was this doctor. He treated Olympic stars. He was just seen to be someone who could not possibly be doing something like this. And I think also there's probably some people who do stand by this excuse that this was a medical procedure, who maybe believe that it was a legitimate medical procedure and that these women are mistaken. Obviously, a court of law disagrees with that. But, you know, Klages, she is unique, but she is not the only person who for quite some time decided to try and stand by Nassar. And, you know, these crimes in some ways are similar to William Strample, Nassar's former boss and dean, who has been accused and has been charged of not overseeing Nassar and essentially trying to protect him while he was still at MSU.
So what's next after this preliminary exam?
So preliminary exams, it's a very low threshold. So it's very likely that the case is going to be sent to circuit court, where it will then be set for trial. That date is probably going to be quite a ways out. Like I mentioned before, William Strample has been charged. He passed through the preliminary hearing stage, and we are still waiting for him to go to trial. So I think it's probably going to be a lot of nothing for a little while. And in the meantime, the investigation into Michigan State University by the Attorney General Special Prosecutor continues.
Shayna Roth is Michigan Radio's Capitol reporter. Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Thursday, which means Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to talk about his latest column. How you doing, Daniel?
Good. How are you?
Just fine. Hey, your column today is on Cadillac's move from New York back to Michigan. You noted this is kind of a repeat of what Lincoln did about 20 years ago. In what way?
Well, Lincoln, in an attempt to find its mojo, decided to move out to Irvine, California in about 1998. This was part of Jack Nasser's then CEO's idea to remake Ford. And about 4 years later, it came slinking back, having gotten more sun, but not a lot more customers. And in fact, it went into a very dark period that it's only now starting maybe to come out of. So Cadillac tried to do the same thing 4 years ago. We're going to go to New York. We're going to get a hipper image. We're going to hire people who are part of this coastal, cool, elite, big money kind of crowd, and they're going to help us sell Cadillacs. Well, it hasn't really worked out that way. And the guy who was heading Cadillac, who was originally South African, had been at Audi and Infiniti, was heading Cadillac. He was pushed out earlier this year, very unceremoniously, and replaced by a longtime GM executive. At the time, the president of General Motors went to New York and said, we're going to stay here. We're invested in New York. This is all about building the brand. This is where we are. And now fast forward to yesterday, they confirmed that they're moving the brand back to not even Detroit, but to Warren. Now, imagine if you're one of the 70 people who was hired from the East Coast, and all of a sudden you're being told that the business is moving to Warren, Michigan.
Well, that is where the campus is. Let me ask you, you said sales slipped since Cadillac went to New York. Mm-hmm. How much?
12% from some numbers that I got from Edmunds yesterday, and their market share has slipped about 2 percentage points in the luxury market in the United States. It's clearly a brand in reverse if you look at the metrics. One of the things that the former CEO who was ousted was criticized for is that he was building a lot of sales in China, which is great and it's important, but sales in the United States were languishing and kind of going in the wrong direction. And really, I think in the case of General Motors, you've got to be strong in China and the United States for those brands to be successful. And they were not, and they had put some product bets in the wrong places.
What should these two, Cadillac and Lincoln, as you call them, Detroit's surviving luxury brands, do to compete with the global luxury brands such as Audi and BMW and Mercedes and so on?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at things. Cadillac has thought that they could compete with the Germans head-to-head. They make a big deal out of the fact that they test their vehicles at the Nürburgring, which is the one of the most famous racetracks in the world in Germany. Lincoln has pretty much decided, we're not going to do that. And part of the reason they've decided that is because they've come to the conclusion, which I think is very realistic, that it's impossible to out-German the Germans. And when you think about a BMW, for example, it's been known as the ultimate driving machine for 40 years. Okay, so I mean, they have a very iterative process of building their brands within the luxury space. And the luxury space is a club, and the club's rules are set by the Germans. I mean, that's just the way it works. And I think what these companies are finally realizing is we can't beat them at their own game. So you've seen Lincoln come out with this massive Navigator, which is making huge profits for Ford Motor Company, but it's really aimed strictly at American consumers. There's not a German consumer is even considered in that vehicle. It is a living room on wheels, no question about it, a high-tech living room on wheels. And it's making them a lot of money. So I think they're starting to embrace that and saying, for us, the play is the United States customer and the Chinese customer.
What's the lesson for Cadillac?
I think in a lot of ways, it's that it's all about the product and it's being in the right place at the right time. In the last 4 years, Cadillac has brought out some really good cars, but the market is walking away from cars, the traditional three-box sedan, and really focusing on all manner of SUVs, particularly compact and smaller SUVs. It's either the big monster boats like an Escalade or a Navigator, or it's the compact ones like this new XT4 they're bringing out, which is very late to the game. And I think that's symbolic of where Cadillac is. They made some of the wrong calls at the wrong time, and now they're paying the price.
Daniel House is business columnist for the Detroit News. The headline of the column today is Under Pressure to Perform, Cadillac Bolts Big Apple for Home. Hey, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
This year's midterm election is being described by some pundits as a once-in-a-generation event. To better understand the issues that are most important to Michigan voters, we've dispatched reporters and producers across the state to ask people two questions. One, what are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And two, what concerns you most about our political climate right now? From now until the election, we'll be bringing you their answers in a segment called Voter Voices. This is our first installment.
My name is Mary Clark. I'm from Interlaken. I'm retired. I believe in the border, getting a border. Immigration laws need to be a little bit stronger. Taxes are way too high. And the automobile insurance rates are way too high. We're highest in the nation, I think. The right is getting so terrible. That's the way I feel. They won't give President Trump any credit. Let him do his job. He's doing what he promised. The economy is a hell of a lot better. So let's keep it like that. Yeah. I think the Dems should loosen up a little bit and go along with the president.
My name is Adam. I live in Hamtramck, Michigan, and I am an engineer and a local business owner. The most important issue to me would be insurance. We live in an area, Hamtramck / Detroit, where insurance is way too high. Other issues are like the roads. The roads are, especially here in Hamtramck, there's potholes almost on every street. Well, I'm a Yemeni American, so the foreign policy right now is not too satisfying. Like, yeah, the immigration ban, I'm sure you've heard about that, is the number one issue for me, because we almost everybody here that are Yemeni Americans have relatives overseas. I know a few people that have close relatives, like their wife, their husband, you know, or brother or sister that they want to bring here. And with the immigration ban, you can't, almost, you know, impossible to bring someone over here.
Special thanks to Rozzy Joffrey and Interlaken Public Radio's Morgan Springer and Daniel Washura for recording these interviews. Coming up, we'll check in with the new superintendent of Flint Community Schools. We'll talk challenges, goals, and what the first few weeks of school have been like. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico last September. Here we are a year later, and some people, especially in the island's interior, still only have intermittent power. Some faculty and students at the University of Michigan have been working with farmers to generate some power using a biomass gasifier. Joining me now are Yvette Perfecto, a professor of environment and sustainability, and Jose Alfaro, an assistant professor who teaches about renewable energy. So, Yvette, you went to Puerto Rico last year with a completely different kind of research in mind. How did Hurricane Maria change your plans?
Well, we were there about a month before the hurricane hit, and we just got a grant from USDA to do research on coffee farms, basically studying how biodiversity contribute to the sustainability and the productivity of coffee, looking at ecosystem services of the biodiversity in coffee farms. And we were just starting that project when Hurricane Maria hit. And obviously that changed everything because it hit very badly. It caused a lot of damage in the entire island, including the central mountainous region where coffee is produced. So many of the coffee farms were devastated.
I was going to say, how bad were rural areas hit? Do you still see the damage a year later?
You can still see some of the damage. Basically, many communities were isolated because of the roads. There were a lot of landslides and blockages to the roads, and that took a while to clean up. There were some communities that even a month after the hurricane were still isolated.
Yeah, we should say that, you know, Agriculture is a $2 billion industry in Puerto Rico. They produce coffee, as you mentioned, citrus crops, plantains. So what did it do, the hurricane, do to the ability to produce food?
Right after the hurricane, production went way, way down. Fortunately, Puerto Ricans eat a lot of tubers. These are root crops. Mm-hmm. And even though the vegetative part of the plant was destroyed, the tubers were still on the ground. So people were eating a lot of what we call viandas. These are tubers, things like ñame and jautia and malanga, things like that.
I'm going to take your word for that.
Yes.
But I think it's important to point out that even though it's a large industry in Puerto Rico still imports a lot of its food. And,
right.
And this makes things worse.
Considering the extensive damage the hurricane did to the island, what did you think you could do to help since your research was pretty well canceled for the moment?
Well, that's when we started thinking about what could we do. And since one of the most affected areas was energy, we got together a group of faculty in the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. And that's how I reached out to Jose, who has been doing a lot of work related to renewable energy. And we brainstormed about what could be some potential projects that we could develop and brought this idea to the dean of the school. And they basically embraced this idea, contributing to renewable energies in Puerto Rico by establishing gasifiers, which are a machine that basically use biomass to produce gas, and then construct hybrid systems that would be establishing a microgrid.
Well, let's talk about some of that because, you know, you kind of had to make it from scratch in Michigan first as a pilot and then try to make it in Puerto Rico. How did that work?
Well, that's a really interesting question because it's a lot of my work is in developing countries. And so I always find that depends on where you go. So going to the U.S., Puerto Rico, an area of the U.S., I felt like things would go a little faster. It didn't. So we built one here at the Mathai Botanical Gardens at the university, got the students trained so they could do it in Puerto Rico. And when they got to Puerto Rico, it took them almost a month to build a prototype. And so
you couldn't take the raw material with you, right?
And we didn't want to. We wanted to make sure that this is something that you could reproduce in Puerto Rico. If there was an entrepreneur that wanted to do this, then we wanted them to be able to do it. And it turns out they can. It just takes a lot of running around getting parts.
Now, I need to understand how this biomass gasifier works and what it does and how that leads to power.
Maybe I can even step back a little bit. The reason this is such a cool project for me is we had already been doing work in Africa tying solar energy to biomass. And what we had been discovering is that it could bring down the cost of energy of these microgrids. And so the other part that's really interesting is it actually incentivizes farmers because we're using residues that the farmers have in the farm to create the energy.
The waste after the crop's harvest.
The waste. And we hate calling it waste because it's really not a waste. It's a big supply.
It wasn't until
supply.
Now.
Yeah, well, and so the way the gasifier works is you put this residue into it and it goes through a process called pyrolysis, which literally comes from the Latin breaking down by heat. We create heat inside the reactor. It's a tube a little shorter than a man. And in the top, the biomass goes. There's a little fire with very little oxygen happening at the bottom. There's different stages of decomposition that are occurring throughout that tube. And what you get out of the reactor is what we call syngas, which is mostly hydrogen and some carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide. But it's flammable, and it can be used to power not just for cooking and heating applications, but it also is almost a drop-in for any spark ignition engines. So your gasoline engines, your natural gas, so you can create electricity.
Does it have to be concentrated, compressed? How do you know?
No, the engine pulls it, creates suction through the operation of the engine. That's what creates the draft through the reactor.
How much energy can you produce with one of these?
That's a great question. We're focusing on small applications. We're talking 5 kilowatts, 10 kilowatts. But there are gasification systems that are really big. There's a company in California that's making them turnkey for 20 kilowatts. And that could probably power quite a few homes in the U.S., probably a whole neighborhood.
But that wasn't the plan in Puerto Rico. You're just trying to get some small grid set up for little isolated areas that are still without power. Have they been embracing this idea? I mean, how's the pilot project gone?
Well, they might not be without power anymore. PREPA, the utility in Puerto Rico, has restored power.
But they can still save money, right?
Absolutely. And while we were there, there was a tropical storm coming. Just the rains that brought left 12,000 people without power for a weekend. So this is about resilience. This is about energy independence, as well as cutting costs. It's a win-win.
So you got one on the ground up and running?
Not yet. Okay. We have one on the ground for research purposes because we want to make sure that the farmers get a benefit from this as well. So the part I didn't mention that comes out of the gasifier is the biochar, which is the remaining carbon in this material. It's very inert, and there's some research that points to being able to use it to store carbon in the soil and to improve the farmer's production.
So you're back to the coffee plantations,
yes,
right?
Yes, it comes back to the farms. This is one of the components of our research program there, is to figure out what could be the benefit of adding biochar to the farms. So what we envision is almost like a closed system. To give you an example of what we're thinking about, a coffee farm that also has the processing plant for processing the coffee can receive biomass or use biomass from the waste of processing the coffee and use that to generate energy that they will use then in the processing itself, and in addition generate the biochar. And that biochar could be put back in the fields to enhance the soil and also sequester carbon in the long run.
We've been talking to Yvette Perfecto and Jose Alfaro, faculty at the University of Michigan, about their efforts to help some rural areas of Puerto Rico as the island struggles to recover from Hurricane Maria and establish more sustainable farming. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting us.
The Flint Community Schools District's new superintendent is on the job now, and we thought we'd check in with him. Derek Lopez, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks a lot, Lester. How are you today?
Just fine. You're the new kid in school. How's the school year going so far?
Oh, it's going really well. The first part of the year has launched really well. Our kids are engaged and ready to learn. Our teachers are there, ready to teach them, and we're just really happy about the start of the school year thus far.
You've been an administrator in schools in the Detroit suburbs. What did you learn there that you can bring to Flint to help the kids?
So everything that I've actually done in my past professional life in education has actually prepared me for the work here in Flint. And they're just bits and pieces that I've brought from my experience in Pittsburgh and my experience in Southfield, even my experience as a nonprofit leader. But most of all, it's really about figuring out how to make sure that our kids are available to learn, meaning that all of the things that are outside that are actually noise in their lives, we've got to figure out how to mitigate those negative factors so that they can come to school and be ready to learn or available to learn. And that really is about wrapping your arms around the entire child so that they can actually get to the academic content that is being measured on these state assessments.
Well, let's talk about the challenges in that direction. More than 93% of Flint school kids are living in an economically disadvantaged mm-hmm. situation. I mean, how much does that affect educating them?
So it affects everything. So the 93% number is, in fact, the key indicator for with respect to academic achievement and poverty is the number one indicator. There is a direct correlation between those kids in poverty and their academic achievement, simply because the barriers that are placed in front of kids because of economic disadvantage really do disadvantage their literacy skills and disadvantages their numeracy achievement. So a youngster who was actually born into poverty experiences less books in the household, experiences less time being read to, and therefore they don't speak the language that is academic English until they get into the classroom, which which puts them far behind those youngsters who are in middle class or upper middle class households who have literacy rich households. That literacy rich household, the kids are oftentimes engaged in questioning. They actually, their parents are actually more apt to read to them, and they're actually able to hear that academic language. So therefore, when they see that academic language on an exam or on the first day of school, they'll say, "Oh, that word represents this," because language is alive. But words on paper, they're actually dormant and stagnant, and they're just a representation of the lives that our kids actually lead. So it's important for us to recognize that if a kid doesn't have those experiences before they get to classes, then they're not going to be able to adapt to the stuff that is in front of them that is academic English. Hope that made some sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Something linked to that I want to ask about. This is from the Michigan dashboard of the school, mm-hmm. and it said across the board on MSTEP and ACT scores at every grade that was measured, the rate of proficiency is below 15%. Now, how do you – that seems like a significant hurdle for both teachers, the administrators, and the kids. How do you tackle that?
So you have to tackle it with a laser. So there are a couple of things that are key leverage points to attacking that 15% proficiency or less than 15% proficiency rate. First thing is making sure that our kids are available to learn. I talked about that with respect to mitigating those barriers around their Maslow needs, their food, nutrition, shelter.
Yeah, you need to explain what the hierarchy of Maslow is. So.
Sure. So Maslow's hierarchy of needs talks about that pyramid moving towards self-actualization. So kids who are at the lower part of the pyramid, which is their survival needs, which is where our kids are stuck, that's the physical need for food, shelter, clothing. And then there's the next level of the pyramid that is about love and care. Then there's the next level of the pyramid, which is about relationships and making sure that those relationships are whole in life. And then you get up to self-actualization, because once you go through survival and your emotive care needs, then you can begin to think about the things that are important in life and therefore become self-actualized. So that's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Our kids are at the lower two tiers of Maslow's hierarchy of needs with respect to their need for food, shelter, clothing, and survival, and their need for love and care. When you can move them into the third level, which then helps them to sort of be ready to receive that data for learning, then, in fact, you've actually begun to educate them. That's on the kid side. On the adult side, our educators have been beaten down for the last two decades by No Child Left Behind and all those things that the state has put upon them. So our educators are feeling less than efficacious around their work product. So we have to rebuild them. We have to rebuild their sense of self. We have to rebuild their capacity and give them the tools and the toolkit that are necessary for them to actually educate children. That includes an up-to-date curriculum. That includes making sure that our teachers actually have manipulatives, that kids can move things from concrete to the abstract. That includes making sure that our teachers themselves are cared for and feel well themselves, because what we have not talked about is that our teachers and administrators are suffering the secondary trauma that's related to the primary trauma that has actually been put upon our kids and families in Flint. So those are the two prongs upon which I'm going to be working as directly as I can to make sure that our kids are educated and therefore succeed on those exams. So kid wellness and adult wellness are the key to making sure that we achieve what we need to achieve.
I'm wondering if you've gone around to the schools and talked to the kids, and if so, what was your message to the kids in your schools?
Yeah, so I have actually been able to go and talk with some youngsters, and they light up my day because they are so full of hope. They're so full of what the possibilities are, and they're depending on us as the adults to make that a reality for them, no matter if they're age 6 or if they're age 16 or 17 and they're seniors at Southwestern Classical Academy. They're depending upon our adults and on the adults to make sure that their lives are whole at school so that they can have full lives. And so all I've heard from youngsters is, man, this is a great start to the year. Can we do this? Like our seniors want to go on these trips. So they're like, Mr. Lopez, can you make it possible for us to go to another place so we can actually experience another location? We're absolutely going to try to make that happen with our partnership. Our babies are asking, hey, you know, can we have a new playground? Because we really need a new playground because our playground equipment is old and dilapidated. And I'm like, hey, we're going to work to do that with our partners here in the community and maybe even with our national Kaboom partner to really build playgrounds as a community exercise around our schools. All of those things tell me that there is hope embedded in their lives, and we as the adults cannot disappoint them.
Now, I know that schools is under a lot of liability debt, and there are buildings that need repair that aren't getting repaired. But rather than get into all of that, let me just try to sum it up in this one question.
Mm-hmm.
Looking short term, at the end of this school year, what do you hope is your most significant contribution?
Wow. So what I would hope I would have been able to do is to reestablish strong relationships with and among the various constituencies in the community of Flint to support and grow our kids. That requires the infrastructure to be dealt with. That requires our ability to sort of talk with one another and to, even if we disagree, to not be disagreeable. That requires me to sort of dig deeply into our finances and to figure out how do we actually begin to pay a living wage, a competitive wage to our teachers and to our administrators so that they're not being sort of attracted to districts that actually pay a higher wage because they've had a salary freeze. That requires me to be attentive to the needs of the adults in the system, from the Board of Education all the way down to the classroom and to our parents, so that we can meet the needs of the children that we're seeking to serve. And so my goal really this year, if it's a successful year, is that we have reestablished the necessary relationships with and among the people in the system, with people outside of the system who have the best interests of our kids and families at heart.
Derek Lopez is the new superintendent of Flint Community Schools. It was a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, Lester. Anytime. Have a great day.
Up next, we'll hear a review of Cuban-American writer Ruth Baer's new book of poems. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Ruth Baer is a Cuban-American writer and a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. Her debut novel, Lucky Broken Girl, has won a number of awards. The 2018 Pura Belpre Award is a recognition given to Latino or Latina writers whose work best portrays the Latino cultural experience in a book for youngsters. Well, now Baer is out with her first book of poems. Writer John Freeman has this review.
Ruth Behar's debut collection of poems, Everything I Kept, has been a long time coming. The poems emerged 20 years ago out of a flurry of meditations on mortality that accompanied Behar's 40th birthday. The collection features poems in Spanish and English printed on outfacing pages. It has the effect of volleying the reader between Cuba, where Behar was born, and the United States, where she was raised and still lives. Behar's poetic voice is both stoic and wistful, her style reminiscent of the great Pablo Neruda. At times she yearns for her native Cuba. In other moments, she imagines the political violence endured by her Sephardic Jewish forebears. In the poem entitled Prayer, she writes, "And when I open the door, I hear many keys clanging, the keys my ancestors stubbornly took with them to their exile." For Behar, who travels regularly between Cuba and Michigan, the notion of home is fluid. It's a series of translations between places, a constant yearning for an unfixed point in memory. In Footprints, a poem addressed to her late grandfather, she praises the resilience of the exile. She writes, "The wounds of my labor healed as you tucked tired geraniums into cold beds of Michigan soil. Even the messy footprints you left on the baby blue bathroom rug were odes to life, sweet reproaches to time, smears of eternity." The prose poem form serves as an elegant container for Behar's supple images and symbols. Her plain diction and skill in rendering narratives of great scope are enviable. Everything I Kept is a fierce debut for a Michigan poet whose time in the spotlight is both overdue and well-deserved. No amount of paraphrasing can capture Ruth Behar's themes of longing and resilience, as well as the poem Apples, which makes it a fitting way to close. I regret many things, but none so much as when I refused to buy 5 red apples for little Amanda in Cuba, the granddaughter of the beloved nanny of my childhood. The apples were expensive, it is true, even though they had a few bruises. They were for sale in dollars, so only I could buy them for her. I thought, why does she want apples when it is mango season, and everywhere there are plump, juicy, big, yellow mangoes falling from the trees? But she wanted apples, the ordinary fruit of cold northern lands, and I would not buy them for her. Now it is autumn here. Apples are everywhere, but I long for mangoes. How sour are the apples that would have made little Amanda so happy.
That was John Freeman with his review of Everything I Kept, a book of poems by Ruth Behar. Freeman publishes poetry under the name of Cal Freeman. His newest book, Fight Songs, is out in paperback. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. As you know, in the last few years, the issue of fatal police shootings of Black Americans is getting a lot more attention. Police training is seen as one of the answers. But is it? Joseph Cesario is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Michigan State University, and he's done some research on this issue. He recently wrote a piece about this for The Conversation. So in the article, you write that implicit bias training is usually what people turn to, departments turn to, as a way to help change the beliefs that officers have about minorities. The goal is to reduce this racial disparity of cops shooting Black people. But there are assumptions underlying those interventions. But you ask, are the assumptions underlying those interventions reasonable? Why wouldn't they be?
The one reason why they might not be reasonable, and this is what got us started on this research, was that the beliefs that people have about the broader nature of fatal police shootings are actually incorrect, okay, or are at the very least not representative of police shootings in general. So as we hear more and more about police shootings, and as the media has done a good job of reporting on these events, these very important events more and more, what's happened is that only one kind of police shooting has been being reported on. And we were concerned that this was giving people actually an incorrect impression of what all police shootings were like or what the majority of police shootings were like. And so if you look, nearly all of the nationwide reporting on officer-involved shootings concern generally Black males, okay, young Black males being shot by the police. And that's absolutely an important thing. There's no question about that. But as we were able to look in more detail at the data nationwide, what we found was that the kinds of shootings that were being reported on were a very small proportion of actual police shootings, of actual fatal police shootings. And so interventions such as implicit bias training make sense if that's what all of those shootings are like. But in fact, when we looked at the data, we found that the police shootings were very different than what people thought they were. And because of that, training like implicit bias training, we think, is not going to do much.
Well, you note that Black Americans make up about 13% of the population, but make up over 30% of the people fatally shot by the police. So you would think, well, that's disproportionately high. What lies behind that if it's not implicit bias?
Sure. Like a lot of these kinds of disparities that we see, people see that disparity at the population level and make the assumption then that what the cause of that is that someone is making a bad decision, right? That officers are biased, that if you look at school suspension rates, that teachers are biased, okay, and that is what's causing that population level disparity. What we found is for fatal police shootings, what accounts for that population disparity is actually encounters with the police. Okay. And so once you control for how much exposure different racial groups have with the police in violent crime contexts, that the, actually that racial disparity disappears. And so our argument was that it actually is less likely that it's about a biased decision on the part of the police officer, and more likely that it's a pure contact issue, that there's just greater rates of contact across different racial groups with the police.
Well, I want to understand this a little better because, you know, what you're saying kind of sounds like a very uncomfortable premise, the idea that black people are just more likely to be involved in criminal activities. Is that what your study suggests?
Well, let's take two things before – let's answer that in two ways. The first way is to recognize that for any racial group, violent crime is extraordinarily low. Okay. And so if you look at something like murder, non-negligent manslaughter rates, even if you look at broad violent crime, those numbers are very, very low, meaning that for any racial group at all, regardless of what the racial group is, it's highly unlikely that you're going to encounter someone from that group who would do something like kill you, okay, or commit murder, right? So the overall rates are very, very low across groups, meaning that the far majority of people of any racial group do not commit violent crime. They don't commit homicide. They don't commit non-negligent manslaughter and so on. So that's the first point to recognize. And people often get tripped up on that and say, oh, you're saying all of this group are like this. Not at all, actually. If anything, almost all of every group is not a violent criminal. Okay. That said, then, if you look at among the small number of people who do things like commit murder or non-negligent manslaughter or violent crime, there are racial group differences in crime rates, okay, across those groups, and they follow actually what the racial group patterning is for being shot by the police. So Asian Americans are the least likely to be shot by the police, okay, also have the lowest violent crime rates, then followed by whites, Hispanics, and then blacks. And for all of that, it's almost always men. Okay, and that is also another way to think of this. If you look at the data in the data sets that we analyzed, in terms of sex, men are about 24 times more likely to be fatally shot by the police than women. Okay, so 24 times more likely. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude of that, in our data, on a per capita level, black Americans are about 3 times more likely to be shot than white Americans. Okay, so the sex disparity is massive there, 24 times more likely. Okay, however, it's also the case that males are also massively more likely to be violent criminals and to be involved in violent crime situations, and that also accounts for that disparity.
Do you take into account things like more African Americans live in poverty and more poverty means more desperation and things like that? Do you take into account the things that black males in Detroit complain about a lot, and that is walking while black, you're suddenly pulled over by the police for no apparent reason? You know, if you're looking for trouble from the black male population, mm-hmm. You're going to be more likely to find it.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And let me give you two answers to that. One is that the data that we analyze are strictly concerning fatal police shootings. No other level of use of force, or any other kind of discretionary policing. That's really important because in a lot of data, what you find is very clear racial disparities, even controlling for crime rates, for all kinds of use of force. Taser use, all kinds of discretionary policing behaviors, you can find those racial disparities. What we find and what other people have found as well, though, is that that doesn't apply then once you get to deadly force. So that deadly force is actually a different kind of decision, and it's a different kind of use of force than other less lethal methods of force. So that's one important point when you bring up the idea of driving while black or something like that. That's a completely separate kind of policing behavior. Okay. With respect to whether we were able to look at something like socioeconomic status, in our data we don't have that, but it's perfectly possible actually that that socioeconomic status accounts for all of these things. And what we're really picking up on are differences in crime rates across socioeconomic levels, and that race happens to correspond with that. We can't rule that out, and that's certainly a very likely possibility. We raise that possibility as well. It's that what we have and what we can look at are racial statistics. And in part, you know, that's what everybody's interested in. That's what we talk about.
So in response to many of these police shootings, there have been measures like the implicit bias that we talked about, the implicit bias training, body cameras. What does your research say about these measures as effective interventions in reducing police shootings of black people?
Sure. So police shootings of all kinds for any racial group, police shootings over the last 3 years, which are the only years that we have good data on this question, have remained remarkably stable. Now, that's not to say that certain departments aren't decreasing in their numbers and other departments may be increasing in their numbers. But at a nationwide level, there's been very, very little movement in the number of individuals fatally shot by the police. When we look at the data and we look at the relation between violent crime situations and fatal police shootings, what that suggests is that something like implicit bias training is going to have very little effect on those behaviors. And that is because when you look at the data, the bulk of fatal police shootings involved people who have an active, ongoing, immediate threat either to an officer or to another citizen. Now, just to be clear, that's not to say that all situations are like that. And certainly the ones that aren't like that are the most important ones, right? Case of of Stephen Clark in Sacramento, you can, you know, take case after case after case where someone has been doing literally nothing and has been shot by the police. Those are really important.
We should note that your study did not come to a definitive conclusion about police shootings of unarmed black people.
That's right. So, and the reason for that is that the number of individuals, white or black, who are shot by the police while unarmed is very small each year. And so we just can't draw reliable conclusions from such small numbers.
So is there any chance those kinds of shootings might be influenced by bias?
That very well could be. And that is the kind of shooting that also could be impacted by something like implicit bias training. So implicit bias training like that may move the needle on those types of shootings. However, it is not going to move the needle on the bulk number of shootings because those kinds of shootings of unarmed individuals who aren't, you know, let's say punching an officer in the face or something while they're shot, they're very, very small numbers. And so the idea behind implicit bias training being that all officers are biased and they show bias, and that the reason why we see these population disparities is due to that bias, that does not seem to be supported by our data.
So what is the big takeaway? What is the conclusion and what else needs to be studied?
One big takeaway is something that is generally lost in, I think, in these kinds of discussions. Again, if you're looking at the bulk of fatal police shootings, the thing that would reduce those shootings the most is simply to reduce violent crime and especially to reduce firearm violence. Those are the situations in which officers are discharging their weapons by and large. Just to repeat, not to undermine the importance of the shootings of unarmed individuals in the least. They're very, very important. But moving the needle on fatal police shootings the most would happen by a reduction in people carrying firearms and using firearms illegally. That will make up the bulk of fatal police shootings. The second thing is, with regard to those situations where you do have an individual officer who shoots an unarmed individual, and it might reasonably be the case that bias, racial bias, has played a role in that decision, what we really need to do is to identify those officers, be able to measure and assess reliably the amount of racial bias that an officer has, understand why that officer is showing that bias, and then do some targeted training for those officers. And that is not what's being done currently. That's a much more difficult thing to do. It's much easier to give implicit bias lectures to entire departments all at once. But I don't think that that's really going to be so helpful, as opposed to really finding out and figuring out why it is that one or another officer might show such bias.
The article in The Conversation is A New Look at Racial Disparities in Police Use of Deadly Force. The author is Joseph Cesario at Michigan State University. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Lester. I really appreciate the opportunity.
After the interview, Cesario and I got talking, and he made the point that there's this misperception that cops who are white are the ones more likely to shoot black people.
We do have data on this question, and actually there's no effect of officer race on whether they are more likely to shoot white or black citizens. Hmm. So black officers are just as likely as white officers to shoot black American citizens.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.